Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Astrologers Podcast, a talk about astrology and the powers of memory and how we can use artificial memory techniques to build quality of life and leadership skills. My name is Andrew Watt and I'll be your host. My guest this morning is Jenna Lee Taylor. Jenna Lee is a TEDx presenter, a Toastmaster of very high standing. She's currently serving as a regional advisor for, I believe, Region 6, which is the upper Midwest of the U.S. No, I beg your pardon. No, that's right, isn't it?
Yes, I am in Region 6. It is Canada, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, and a few other little bits and pieces.
Fantastic. She's an amazing speaker, and we were meeting up with one another in Nashville for mid-year training, and she mentioned that she had memorized her speech for her TED presentation. And I said, how did you do that? And she explained in perfect detail Palace of Memory techniques without actually knowing that that's what they were called. And I thought, I have to have her on the show. Jenna Lee, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Such a random occurrence that led to this great connection. So I appreciate it.
This is actually the second time that we've tried recording this episode. The first time didn't work out too well. We had some internet difficulties and had to abandon the project. But you said something about having a very bad memory as a kid. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't remember the fact that we did this. But no, I'm kidding. No, it does strike me as funny that I am serving as a guest on a podcast about memory, because that is not something that I have ever claimed to be good at. I have to keep notes. I have to set reminders. I have to set alarms. And I think part of it is because I have a very large cyst in my brain. And the part of my brain that is not there is the part that serves for short-term memory. So I can remember things that happened a long, long time ago, but anything that happened about 15, 20 minutes ago, I have to really stop and think about to remember. So memorization has never been a huge part of my life. I was in theater, but that's more of a communication. That's a talk between two people. So if I couldn't remember exact lines or phrasing, I just thought about who my character was and responded accordingly. So when it comes to presentations now, I wing it, for lack of a better term. I know my topic. I know the ideas that I want to get across, but actually memorizing my presentations just stresses me out too much and I lose that connection. But then it came time for my TED Talk. And a TED Talk, without being too dramatic, is basically the presentation of a lifetime. And depended on exact wording, exact memorization, not only for the timing, but for light cues, for the slides coming up, everything was dependent on knowing exactly what I needed to say and when I needed to say it. And that scared me. Terrified, really. Terrified is probably a better word. I didn't think I was going to be able to do it.
And yet you did.
I did.
Which, of course, means that you wrote a speech, you memorized it word for word, and you gave that speech.
Correct. I went into it with the thought process that I was never going to be able to memorize it. And it took me quite a while to get over that thought process. And I tried different methods. I initially typed the speech out on my computer, but then I would handwrite it several times to try to get that muscle memory in with the words.
Sure.
I would record it and I listened back to it over and over and over and over and would repeat it part by part by part. Or I would try to memorize the last paragraph and then do the last two paragraphs and work backwards. But nothing was really connecting, and I had to to really analyze how I learn in general, not just memorizing, but how I learn, how I respond best in learning situations. And I had to combine a couple of different things to get the speech to stick. So what I ultimately did is I pictured myself going through my house. And the intro of my speech was on the porch. And that's where I memorized. I would physically stand there and think about the intro of my speech. And I would have different visual cues of, okay, the beginning of my TED Talk talks about my grandmother. It starts out, my grandmother, Mary Jane, taught me to always talk to strangers. So I imagined being on the front porch with my grandmother and strangers walking by the front of the house, and we were interacting with them. So I physically was on the front porch memorizing the beginning of my speech.
That's fantastic.
And then I would move into to the entryway, and that would be the next section. And then I would go to the kitchen and talk about the next section. So whenever I was having issues with a transition of not knowing what was coming up next, I just imagined where I was in my house. The next steps took me to the next room, which connected me to the next part of my speech.
About how long a section did you memorize in each location?
And it was different for each one. Sometimes it depended on exactly what I was talking about. Sometimes I had to correlate the section with the room in weird ways that maybe didn't make as much sense. Like the porch makes a lot of sense with everything going on there. So it depended on the part of the speech and the part of the house, but no more than about two paragraphs really for any one location.
Yeah, that's about right. So the idea of chunking information into smaller pieces, number one. Number two, having a defined path through the house. And you're certainly in line with a lot of the speakers about, or the writers about, Palace of Memory techniques from the Middle Ages, who said that real locations were to be preferred over imaginary locations. Mm-hmm. I'm also interested in the fact that here you are on your front porch in your talk, and your grandmother is there in your memory with you. In other words, you are connecting both the image of place and the memory of a specific person in that location.
And there were a couple of times I even went one step further, and I had sense of smell as well. My grandmother loved lilacs, so I have a lilac hand lotion, and I would smell the lilacs on the front porch, so I would have the hand lotion with me, and I would smell it as I was going through that area, which also added another sense into the memorization.
Right. So you have memory of image. That's one of the core techniques that we've inherited from the classical Greek and Roman world. And you have memory of image, which is a sense picture or a sense movie. They didn't have film and video yet, so they didn't think of these images as moving, but the more advanced practitioners said including motion into your images is valuable and important, mm-hmm. rather than just creating static pictures. I think this is fantastic. How long did it take you to memorize the speech?
Way too long for someone who hates memorizing in general. I would say it took me a solid month to really memorize it to a point that I wasn't questioning myself.
Interesting, because there's a great memory practitioner by the name of Giordano Bruno, who was executed for heresy by the Roman Catholic Church in 1600. And he says that the most advanced techniques take 4 to 6 months to learn.
Huh.
So you're actually performing considerably better than the average with what he thought it would take in order to develop this kind of a trained memory.
Well, I'm always really hard on myself anyway, so that makes sense.
Have you used these techniques to memorize other things?
I hate memorizing. So I really think that it's a great skill to use. I know that I will use it in the future now that I know that I can, but I still try not to because it stresses me out. You know, I was actually just recently named a presenter at another similar event, but this one's a little more strict, where you have 20 slides, 15 seconds each slide, and it auto advances. I have no control, zero control over the advancement of the slides. And I have to be so exact with my words. So I know that I'm going to have to use this again very, very soon.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear that. I bet that it does not take a full month to memorize, but I think you should allow yourself a month and a half just in case.
It's at the end of April and I haven't written it yet, so it's going to have to be a month. I might have to speed the process up just even a little bit more.
Do you think that practicing this speech improved your imagination?
You know, it almost sounds counterintuitive to say that memorizing something makes you more imaginative, because the act of memorization is doing the same thing over and over and over in the same exact way. But I think that it does, because you can find different techniques, different senses, you bring in different aspects of the world around you. So it's not just about saying the same things again and again or memorizing facts. It's about utilizing the other parts of the brain and the other things that make you unique, your other skills, to memorize. So I think that it does enhance creativity, even though that seems like that wouldn't work.
Interesting. Do you have any examples of that? Is there any experience that you can call to mind of how you found your imagination actually was helping you in the course of memorizing this speech for the TED Talk?
And not even just this speech, but I can remember back even in high school having to memorize facts for tests. American history was the bane of my existence. I hate dates. I hate names. I'm really bad at that. Oh, what was that actor in that one movie? I'm not good at memorizing those things. So I had to make up songs for the facts and the dates, or I would find songs. There was this great animated series on when I was little called The Animaniacs, and there was a song about presidents. That is the only way I passed government, because it had all of the dates and the names and different facts about the presidents that you would sing in this song. So I memorized the song, and then during tests, I would sit there and I would sing the song in my head, kind of dancing in my seat, and I could remember the facts enough to pass the tests.
That's a great example, actually, because here's a case of you deciding to memorize the song. In other words, memory of music ties into these kinds of artificial memory techniques, as they were called in the Middle Ages, that it's not just memory of image or memory of place, that the music and the tune is capable of activating the parts of our brains that are not good at remembering facts and figures in a very different way. So that's awesome that you were able to do that.
And even when I'm in stage productions, if I'm in a musical, I will memorize the songs a lot faster than I do the dialogue. It just comes more naturally to have that fun piece of imagination in there too.
And it suggests that if you want something to become culturally relevant and important, creating a song for it is actually a much more useful way of making it part of the culture than just creating a picture of it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That an animated story with music and lyrics is much more likely to become culturally relevant for a longer period of time. I can tell you, being on the other side of that, I can tell you the story of being a teacher in a classroom and having to administer a government test and watching everybody hum the Animaniacs song in their heads. So it's an obvious example of artificial memory technique that really genuinely works. If you were just expected during a TEDx talk to get up and sing, that would make your life so much easier.
It would have been so much easier to sing for 12 minutes than it was to memorize my speech word for word. Yep.
You have to give a lot of speeches as a member of Toastmasters, and specifically as a member of Toastmasters with this very high level responsibility for an entire region which covers multiple states. You're doing conference calls, you're doing speeches in person. How did memorizing the TED Talk change how you prepared for all of these other kinds of speeches that you have to give?
My presentation style in general hasn't changed that much, but my mental state going into them has. Previously, thinking about giving a 45-minute keynote or a two-hour facilitation would stress me out because I would think, oh, I could never memorize that much information. I'm going to get up there. I'm not going to know what I'm talking about. Nobody's going to want to listen to me. Why am I even doing this? And that whole dialogue would go on in my head for days and days and days until I overthought it enough that I stressed myself out and just hated doing it. But being able to memorize my TED Talk made me realize that, first of all, in those situations, I don't have to memorize. Nobody in the audience knows word for word what I'm going to say. And nobody in the audience is sitting there saying, I really hope she sucks and she bombs. They want me to be good. They want to connect with the speaker. So knowing that I am able to memorize took the stress out of it, even though I don't have to memorize. So it made it more enjoyable and it makes it more fun to present, which means the audience has more fun too.
Right. And I have to say that having seen you on stage in Nashville, I saw you go to the podium a couple of times to look at your notes, mm-hmm. but you still spoke for a good 2 hour stretch, not all the time. Some of it was you speaking, some of it was you facilitating the conversations that you organized in the room. But the thing that impressed me was your ability to move away from the lectern to engage with the audience, both as a group and one-on-one in question and answer session, without needing to refer to your notes. That there was a mass of information behind every single answer that you gave to every question from the audience, that even if you don't have exactly the words right, you still have built up a framework of knowledge around this material. Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to sort of become a master of that body of information?
Well, I appreciate that. Master is probably an over-exaggeration. I was of the process. I have been giving presentations for probably the last 14 years. And this style has adapted and changed throughout that time. And it really hasn't been until the last 3 years that I feel I've gotten better at that aspect of it, where I haven't wanted to just cling to my notes and look down every 3 minutes to make sure that it was there. So it's a lot of prep work. It's going over the information again and again and again. So you know what's there. It's in your head. And even if you don't have the exact words, you've memorized the topic enough that you don't have to memorize the exact phrasing.
Okay. So you think that there's a clear difference between the topic and the words?
Yes, absolutely. I think that, and I've seen it happen a lot where there have been presenters or even contest speakers within Toastmasters where they get so focused on memorizing word for word for word for word. And if they miss one "and" or one "the," it throws them off enough that they can't continue. They completely freeze in the moment. I saw one speaker who was giving an 8-minute speech, forgot a word, and it wasn't an important word because we talked about it later. It was a very minute word that they forgot. They had to go back to the very beginning of the speech in their head and recite it to themselves until they got back to that one word to remember it and continue on.
Wow.
The entire presentation, obviously, because they sat there not doing a single thing for about 40 seconds before they could move on with the rest of their presentation. And I know that that's maybe an extreme case, but it happens all the time where people get so focused. And yes, when you are speaking to an audience, you put so much effort into the exact words, the exact phrasing, but memorizing those exact words sometimes gets in the way of connecting or presenting the topic.
That's very interesting. There's a story in Plato. I've forgotten which dialogue it is, but Plato is talking with a professional poet who has all of the Iliad and the Odyssey memorized. Socrates asks the poet to recite the piece where such and such an event happens. And the poet says, "Oh, sure, I know that." And he sort of searches around in his memory and he recites the section that Socrates has asked for. And Socrates says, "Great, what comes just before that?"
Yeesh.
And the poet is
my head would literally explode. I'd be like, "I'm sorry, I can't walk backwards to my house. I don't know, I can only walk forward to my house."
and like you, the poet is completely thrown off. He has to go to the beginning of the previous section and recite forwards for that 40 seconds of mental breakdown on stage in order to find the place that Socrates is talking about. And he's completely thrown off base or off track by the fact that he knows where to start and he knows where the sort of ending points are, but he can't work backwards through the text that he has memorized.
Right. It's like trying to say the alphabet backwards.
Right. It's similar to that.
You know how it ends, but can you say it backwards? I actually memorized it backwards at one point just for a fun party trick, but I still have to think about it.
But that is interesting that it's the sort of thing that is difficult enough that we do treat it as a party trick.
Exactly.
And a valuable and important one. There's a story about Bobby Kennedy and John F. Kennedy that they knew all of Shakespeare's sonnets, that they could recite all of them from memory, that you know, they could throw a number out, 1 to 154, and they could recite any one of the 154 sonnets, but that John F. Kennedy knew how to do one of them backwards.
Wow. Wow.
And the implication was that he could do it for more than one.
I know as soon as we disconnect, I'm going to try again to see if I can remember how to do the alphabet backwards. Now I'm intrigued.
I won't put you on the spot and ask you to do it now.
It might decrease some of my credibility. Who knows? We'll just all say that I can do it. We'll just agree. Right.
We'll just assume that you can, and we'll leave it at that.
Yep. Perfect.
Let's talk a little bit about what you do now and why memory and these kinds of artificial memory techniques are important to what you're doing now in the world. What do you do professionally?
Absolutely. Right now, I own my own business. I am a public speaker and trainer by trade. So I do one-on-one coaching and group sessions in corporate settings focused on public speaking skills, leadership skills, and really the power of connection, whether that's with your employees, your customers, or with your audiences. So that includes presentation skills as well. As far as memorization, not only the sessions that I'm giving, but when I work one-on-one with people, I like to remember facts about them. So I have a couple dozen individual clients that I have that I work one-on-one in coaching. And I like to do callbacks to things that we've talked about before. So maybe I've had 10 sessions with each of these people. Do I remember that John Doe has 3 sons? And so mid-coaching session, we're talking about one of his presentations. And I can say, oh, it would be really great if you could pull in a story about middle son Q. Or know that Sally over here has a horrible fear of snakes, and we can bring that into one of her presentations or use that in her speaking style somehow. So I like to memorize facts about people, because to me, that's my biggest commodity, is working with people and making them feel heard and understood and helping them to excel.
And do you have a sense of how you store the information about people that you're trying to memorize? Do you write it down? Do you sort of hold a picture of them in your mind and imagine, okay, here's John Doe and his 3 children are standing off to the left, and his wife, Susie Smith, is here off to the right, and their house is behind them, and there's a sort of a map floating over the house, and here they are in Illinois in a suburb of Springfield. Like, does the information get stored visually, so to speak?
I had never really thought about that before, but it started as a file, which sounds a lot creepier than it should, but I do have files on basically everyone in my life that I write information down from birthday to favorite color. But then I do turn it into a picture in my head. So when I visualize one of my clients, all of those images pop up. So I'll see the color orange. I'll see a dog. I'll see a wife. I'll see kids in my head, and it makes it so much easier. I used to manage hotels. And my job was to make every single guest who walked through that door feel like family, to make them feel like they were coming home. And I am horrible at names. So I would call everyone sweetheart and honey to make them feel a little more connected. So while I couldn't remember their name, I could absolutely tell you what company they worked for, where they lived, what their favorite breakfast was, what floor they liked to be on. So all of those facts stuck, even though their names didn't. And it started at the beginning of my hospitality career about being able to put those pictures with faces, even if I couldn't remember their names.
Fascinating. So in a sense, these kinds of artificial techniques existed for you as a way of overcoming name blindness.
Correct. And I really, even now talking about it, I didn't realize that I did that with people as well as my presentations. So I'm learning about myself as we're sitting here.
Well, that's ideal. I mean, if the first story about these kinds of artificial memory techniques that we have is that a poet by the name of Simonides was giving a presentation, and the guy whose house he was delivering this talk in didn't like the talk and refused to pay him, and said, you know, go ask the gods for help. And then a messenger came and said, hey, there's a messenger here in the courtyard waiting to talk to the poet. The poet went out. There was a sudden earthquake. The building collapsed. And then the poet not only survived the earthquake because he was standing outside, but he collected a fee from all of the bereaved families of all of the people who'd been at the party by identifying where the guests had been sitting at the time of the earthquake. Sort of a gruesome beginning, but he was able to remember everybody's names based on where they were inside the house at the moment of the building's collapse.
Wow.
So, you know, a gruesome story, but still connected with that idea of being able to walk through space and to be able to identify people, not necessarily by name, but by what they were wearing.
Right.
And sort of where they had been in the building at the moment of collapse. The story itself is interesting because it contains within it the two key pieces of knowledge about how this system works, right? Place, number one, and picture of the person, number two. Words almost have nothing to do with it.
Right, right. I think it also, this whole concept also helps me with convincing other people that they can do it too. Because you don't have to be an expert of memorization. You don't have to have the best memory to be able to visualize people and where they're sitting. You don't have to have the best history of memory to be able to sing a little song in your head and remember a couple of dates. You don't have to have the best memory to memorize a 12-minute speech word for word by associating it with other things that you can memorize.
I think all of that is true. So if people want to know more about your coaching business, how do they find you online and how do they get in touch with you?
I can be found at jennyleetaylor.com. It's very glittery. It's a very glittery site. I was told once in my career that I sneeze glitter wherever I go. And so that theme has followed me throughout my career.
We didn't interact all that much in Nashville, but I did in fact find a piece of glitter in my packet of information that I took home. So you did get everywhere, even yep. though we were just in the same conference rooms.
In fact, there was another similar session going on in Dallas at the exact same time that we were in Nashville. And one of my cohorts sent me a picture, and there was a huge pile of glitter on one of the chairs in their room in Dallas. And she asked if I had snuck in to visit them while I was in Nashville.
I want to wrap up by asking you to tell a story about your time in the hospitality business. I was hoping it would come up earlier. But it's the story about the pillow fort.
Yes, the story of the pillow fort. So I wanted to teach my staff the importance of connecting with our guests, and that they were there to make our guests stay more comfortable. So we turned it into a, you know what, no request is too crazy. So that when a guest asked for feather pillows, my guests or my employees weren't rolling their eyes. So pretty much whatever the guest asked for, we found a way to make it happen. And one guest put in their reservation that they wanted a pillow fort in their room when they checked in. Now, at first, my employees started to laugh and say, oh, what, you know, 40-year-old man wants a pillow fort? And I said, does it matter? Let's make it happen. Let's do it. So we did. We piled a whole bunch of pillows underneath the side table in the room, covered it with a sheet, put a little do not disturb sign on the front of the pillow fort, and gave him cream soda and gummy bears, and left a nice little card saying, welcome, welcome to our hotel. Enjoy your pillow fort. And we were so excited. The next morning we were all, did he come back down? Did he call? Did you hear anything? And we actually never heard from the guest. He never said anything. He never thanked us. He didn't fill out a survey afterwards, but we weren't disappointed, because that wasn't the point. The point wasn't to hear back from the guest. The point was to connect. And my staff continued to find ways to connect with our guests and with each other. And it made the entire hotel feel like a home for everyone who came in because of little events like that.
That's fantastic. And I wanted to get you to tell that story for a couple of reasons. One, I've now heard you tell this in a couple of different ways, and the story is complete and whole every single time, that you use different words and different phrasing, but you don't leave out any details. And it doesn't sound over rehearsed. It doesn't sound forced. It sounds like it's this complete structured story beginning to end, and it has all of the necessary pieces. So all of the necessary pieces somehow are stored in your mind and in your brain in a way that whenever you tell this story, all of the core pieces come out. And I think that has something important to say about memorization, that we don't store perfect words, we store stories somehow as whole pieces.
Yes.
And the second reason that I wanted to do this is that, of course, our listeners aren't going to be able to see you, but now they're going to associate you with the pillow fort and the idea of creating a comfortable, connected atmosphere. And that, I think, is a powerful thing you bring to the world.
I am completely okay with that being the image that comes to mind when people think of me. I am the human embodiment of a pillow fort. I am okay with that.
Well, thank you very much for appearing on The Astrologer's Palace, Jenny Lee. And there will be links in the show notes to all of our listeners so that they can reach out to you and find out more about you and your work if they so choose.
Thank you so much for inviting me on, and I hope to connect more soon.
Sounds great. And remember, if Jenny Lee can do it, so can you. Thank you very much for listening.